Welcome to another one of our private conversations here at Farrer & Co. I am here with a colleague from our disputes department who works with our families in relation to contentious matters. That is where there's some sort of argument or disagreement or complication that needs to be sorted out potentially through the courts. We call it contentious trust, contentious probate, but that's just to sort of give it a little bit more of a human edge. Charlotte Fraser, you're a partner in our litigation department. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
So we tend to work very closely with the other departments in the firm. Often we're supporting them in their ongoing relationships with existing clients. And often it's a question of staving off potential conflicts, working out where those disagreements might come to the fore further down the line, managing existing turbulence within family dynamics or relationships. And often capacity can form quite an important part of that. And it's something that we've talked about a lot in recent years, is actually that those capacity issues don't just happen with the firm's older clients. And I think as a nation, we're becoming much more aware of capacity issues at a much earlier stage in life. And I think that's been one of the difficult conversations that you and I have both had with some of the firm's clients in recent years.
Well, I think what's interesting is when we talk about capacity, everyone else is sort of talking about mental health or mental illness or whatever, but capacity has a very legal element to it. Do you have the ability? Do you understand? Are you being enabled? Are you being protected to make good decisions or bad decisions? Do those have legal ramifications? Do you need an attorney to help you? Do you need to make a decision in the middle of a family disagreement around money that actually you need help with?
And I think that could be quite a difficult thing for people to contemplate, because I think there's a feeling of a potential loss of control. And actually, I think as a good legal advisor or part of a team advising a particular person, a lot of it is reassuring them that actually by putting in place various documents or having discussions with various family members or identifying particular attorneys is actually giving them an insurance policy and protecting them if they do get to the point where they're unable to make a decision for themselves. But again, that's not always an easy conversation with people, I think.
I think that's right. And having revolutionised the law about sort of 12 years ago, we were all very reassured that the law around mental capacity is now dealt with in a much more modern way. But those issues are still there. And whether you have attorneys, some of our clients have trustees who are effectively the people that look out for them. Some of our clients have always lacked capacity. We do have the children of some of our clients who are disabled in a way that from birth they've not been able to make those decisions.
But I think what's so positive about the law, though, is that actually wherever possible, the individual in question is given the opportunity to express what their wishes would be. And I think one of the points that we discuss quite a lot is that capacity can fluctuate. So you might not have capacity one day, but actually the next you can understand the decision that you're contemplating making. And I think as advisors that can be quite difficult to track, and it's important therefore that we communicate with each other and with the clients and their families. But I think also for clients to understand that actually you can understand this particular decision, you can make it for yourself, and you're not going to have that control taken away from you by having in place attorneys or trustees around you. It's all the support network, I think, as much as anything.
That's right, and having that sort of empowerment in the legislation is hugely helpful. I suppose what you and I see is often families knowing that there's a problem coming because there has been some sort of medical diagnosis. But we have both had clients who are somewhat maybe in denial. I suppose just thinking about the families around those who may lack capacity, what do you think worries them the most about what can go wrong in their lives?
Well, it all starts with relationships, I think, between the family members worrying about their children, their parents, whoever it might be that lacks capacity, and actually how they're going to cope with it. I think when someone realises that they might be in the early stages of losing capacity, or there might be issues with memory or their cognitive function, it can be a hugely traumatic process, and often I think they're aware of it themselves a lot earlier than perhaps they might have admitted to anyone else. They can react in a way which can often isolate them from other family members. So there can be anger, there can be a sense of despair, I think, amongst some of our clients. And I think for the family members around them, it's trying to understand what it is that's going on in their mind and how easy it is to have those initial conversations. So I think it starts from a medical perspective before you then get to where lawyers might become involved. I think it's just trying to understand what it is that's actually going on. And only once I think the family have started to get their heads around what that might look like, can they then start to contemplate, well, what can we now do to help that person and to stave off further difficulty in the future?
I mean, I think one of the things we try to do, and you're more on the litigious side, I'm more on the non-contentious side, is that we try to put things like powers of attorney in place even when people are very young, so that you've got that building block in place at least, and that picking your attorneys is the only job the client effectively has to do, because the forms are pretty user-friendly and do what they need to do, and then the law is of great assistance if capacity is lost. I mean, one of the things I always say to clients is, you know, what if you were skiing and you broke both your arms, or you were had a bang on the head, or you just had a car accident or a very bad illness and you didn't really want to have to deal with your own financial affairs or make decisions about things? Why don't you have your husband or your children or your best friend or your life partner, whoever makes sense, as your attorney? Because actually then it's a bit like buying insurance, you know, we put it away and get it out if something bad happens, and you're not wrong by doing it. I think that does help
people
get used to the idea that their capacity can be fragile. It's not all about losing capacity in the way that we would see in the press through dementia or serious mental illness or addiction or something like that, that it can be actually something by chance that one can't control.
And temporary, I think, as well, and can happen at any age in life. And I think particularly when you're dealing with entrepreneurs or clients who've got interest in family businesses, I think it's a question of explaining to them, well, what happens if you were to have this accident and a momentous occasion or decision had to be made in relation to the business? What documents have you got in place that would ensure that that took place even while you were temporarily incapacitated? And I think clients, when they start to think about it in those terms, not necessarily thinking ahead to dementia in the latter stages of their life, I think that's a much easier scenario for them to contemplate.
I think that's right. And I think that having the multi-generational approach that we have, where we're looking after three or four generations of a family sometimes, whether ourselves or with another law firm, it is good to have that joint approach that everybody has an LPA, in the same way that people talk about prenups, and we are going to talk about prenups in another one of our podcasts. That's something that where there is any degree of wealth at all, it's accepted that some sort of agreement about what should happen should be in place. I think similarly for capacity, if everybody has to have a lasting power of attorney for financial affairs, then it just becomes a sort of normal part of doing business.
And you can have a different attorney for your property and financial affairs to the person who you might choose to make decisions over your health and welfare.
Yeah, that's always an interesting one, because you quite often have someone extra to the family who's sort of either a lawyer or an accountant or an FD of the family business on the financial affairs, but you wouldn't expect them to ever take responsibility for health and welfare. And we are seeing a lot more inquiries, aren't we, about the health and welfare side, partly because of the press, but also because our clients, when they do get to the stage where they're going into care or they're having to go into some sort of rehabilitation program or into hospital, the hospitals are saying, where's your lasting power of attorney for health and welfare? And so it's much easier for us to say that everybody needs one, actually, whether you're 25 or 75 or 95, you need an LPA for health and welfare. And I think some of the care homes insist on that you can't go in unless you've got one, unless you've lost capacity already. I think that, for me, the insistence from the medical side of having them has been really helpful in terms of actually persuading clients that they're a good thing to have. And the functionality around those health and welfare powers of attorney, from my point of view, works really, really well. Have you had many disputes around that side of things, or has it been more on the financial side that you've seen full-blown
disputes? It's more on the financial side that we've been involved in the full-blown disputes. We've had quite a lot of early-stage conversations with clients, often their spouses, where they might be about to go into care or to some form of rehabilitation program, and there is a spat ultimately between family members as to who that rightful attorney should be, whether or not they are actually being properly cared for. Quite a lot of concern actually about the way in which people are being treated in the care homes and whether or not they really are getting the best possible treatment. So I wouldn't say they're full-blown disputes, but we are often on hand providing advice to either the attorneys or the close family members who are concerned about welfare issues.
One of the other things that we tend to come up against is the lack of knowledge around end-of-life care as well. And that, again, that could happen at any time. I think you and I were discussing a while ago an article just in one of the BBC News feeds about a very young woman who had had a very bad accident, who had expressed her wishes and actually had quite strong views around end-of-life care. I think it was even an advocate for one of the charities, and she had an illness which made her personality wholly different, meant she couldn't care for herself, and she hadn't signed anything in relation to what her end-of-life care desires would be. Her sister, I think, felt very strongly that she wanted to let her sister go, but the doctors felt strongly because they hadn't got anything to go on, and she had a quality of life, albeit her sister said it was an appalling quality of life, that they didn't feel they could follow through on those wishes. And then she improved to the extent that one wouldn't anyway. And how tragic that was that she'd never actually written it down. And no one would wish her not to have her life. Everyone would want her to survive and have a good quality of life. But had that been in place, it would have been a little bit clearer, I think.
But I think it's so unusual still for people really to set out in any meaningful or formal way what their wishes would be. I still think that's quite unusual. I think that's probably one of the main areas in the sort of realms of capacity where I think there's still quite a lot of work to do in terms of people really getting their head around what they would want and expressing that in a formal way to those around them.
I think some people, they have strong views and some don't have views at all and are quite sort of fatalistic about it. But to have the opportunity to have that conversation with your family or your closest, nearest and dearest, and then to then be able to express yourself to someone like us, and we're lawyers, you know, we're not sitting around the log fire with them discussing these things. It's quite a sort of formal process.
So do you think your conversations with clients have changed? So perhaps in the past they might have come in to speak about a will, but perhaps now there's a wider conversation about attorneyships, end-of-life care, health and welfare more generally?
I think it's very unusual for people to bring it up at the initial meeting, but they are far more open to talking about it. And I think that that's partly to do with society being more open around what we would call capacity issues, whether it's a mental health issue, it's a degenerative disease, whether there's a disability. And so what we try to do when we're taking instructions for things like wills is tease out some information about the family, whether there are any vulnerabilities they're particularly concerned about, for example, a child with a learning difficulty or something like that. But also just to ask very open questions generally about the wider family group. Is there anybody else that they are providing finances to, etc.? And then you draw in lots and lots of threads of what make up the reality of their family and the finances and how they work. And often you do find in families where there's a degree of wealth that there is support going on. And that may well be the case the nation over, but that's particularly acute, I think, where you have maybe one person, an entrepreneur, who's made quite a lot of money, and the family look to them to help them. You tease out those issues where someone might have a mental health problem or have a disability and where there might be a capacity issue, and then you can say, what would happen if something happened to you? Who's going to be in charge of your money? Who's going to make the decisions? And we know, it's a slightly technical point for these purposes, we know that attorneys can't make gifts on behalf of the individual who's lost capacity without going to court. But there are ways in which people's affairs can be managed to make it easier to support the larger family group on a longer term basis. And if you get into that conversation, suddenly it opens up all sorts of doors. And then when you start that conversation, they then tell you even more stuff about the family. So it's a sort of self-fulfilling circle, I think.
This has been, I think, born out of the conversations that we've had on capacity issues with our intermediary contacts, with whom we've done a lot of work over the years. And I think they face exactly the same issues, don't they? That often they'll have a patriarch, a particular family member that they've always taken instructions from, and then the big question arises, what happens if their capacity goes? Where does that leave the rest of the family? Have we got a proper policy in place to deal with that, should that ever arise?
I think so, and I think with the rise of people who have growing wealth actually expecting to have a network of advisors around them, again, those conversations are easier because you can say to their PA, who basically runs their life, you know, what are the procedures around what would happen if there's an accident? Do you have family continuity planning in the same way you'd have business continuity planning? And so I do think that when you're talking about things like capacity, you open up all sorts of different areas for client around the risk to them of things just not being as they should be for whatever reason. And I think that we've really sort of tackled that as a firm, as a team. I mean, you and I have been driving that for a number of years here. And then the intermediary conversations have become so easy because, was it 5-6 years ago, we started talking about it to the people running the money, the people doing all the tax advice, the family offices, the family businesses that we deal with. The conversation's become so easy now, and I think it's just sort of built up like a jigsaw puzzle, really, and it's just become a normal. And it's become a normal part of conversation for us around the clients, rather than it being new.
A lot of it goes into risk management, doesn't it? I think for the clients and for their families, and I think we often have had this arise, certainly on my contentious side of the fence, where we've had clients with addiction issues. And there are potential risks that one can perceive further down the line, or we've had difficulty getting instructions from that particular client and really knowing whether or not they have the capacity to give those instructions. And that's something that definitely requires a wider conversation.
Definitely. I think the other thing that makes life easier is where you have the ability to bring the subject up and not be seen as being intrusive. That's a huge change. I think that's a generational change as well. So in my experience, like 20 years ago, when I was taking instructions from an elderly lady who'd been widowed, there was maybe a trust for her. She had her own money, her own investments. She would very much look to her investment manager or her financial planner to tell her what to do. And the lawyer and the accountant were just for doing your will or doing what was the enduring power of attorney and then doing your tax return. I think we all work much better as teams now with the other advisors. So quite often, actually, with the clients we know really well, I'll say, I need to have a difficult conversation. The clients know that we talk to each other. I need to have a difficult conversation with them. You know, when are you next seeing them? Can we make this as painless as possible around a conversation where we're concerned about a family member? It may not even be them having an issue making decisions well or having an issue with their capacity. And I think the world is just so much more open now anyway that people are quite happy to be supported in that way by a team of advisors who have a sort of mandate to talk about things that might be quite difficult for them and make it easier. And I don't think that's just around mental capacity or mental health. I think there is the sort of the risk element, the philanthropy. There's going to be issues around succession to a family business or to a particular asset. And we do look after quite a lot of families who have had assets for a long time. We're known for having what we might grandly call landed estates. But I mean, they are family businesses, but they have a particular frisson around the heir may be someone who is sort of set in stone with a title or the eldest child or a son or the most able. The families are all different. And actually being able to talk about mental health and about the stresses and strains of having assets like that, which are often sort of asset rich and cash poor, actually means you get much more under the skin of the client. And I think that that means that you in your sort of disputes or litigation capacity have a much better idea of how we might solve or help the family solve what's going on, because you understand the stresses and strains, because we've been able to talk about what if you got depressed again. We know this has happened before, what if it happened again? Do you think it helps?
I think the problem solving is so much easier when the family have been having those conversations either amongst themselves, or at least ideally in most cases if they've actually been involving their advisors in those conversations and there's been some element of planning involved.
Yeah.
I think when we get involved,
anticipation, isn't it? It's sort of anticipating the sort of the worst case scenario.
Well, quite, and just, so often when we get involved and it's perhaps someone who's a new client to the firm, we haven't necessarily had that long history with them, you often come in and everything has exploded completely, yeah. Either as a result of one isolated incident where someone has lost capacity very quickly, or in the case of will disputes where someone has prepared their will in circumstances where their capacity was questionable. Those sorts of situations are so much harder to unpick and find a solution which doesn't blow the whole family apart if people haven't been having those conversations for a long period of time beforehand.
Yeah. One of the things that I think we're really proud of as a team, as a firm, as it were, looking after people with their family businesses in particular, is that succession conversation. And we could talk about succession probably through 5 or 6 podcasts, and maybe that's another idea. But all of these sort of threads of personal information help us help the clients so much better. And succession and risk are such huge issues for clients. They sort of don't even realise the sorts of risks that they're facing. That mental health issue means that it becomes an imperative to talk about what can go wrong. So one of the things that we do talk about quite a lot, and we talk to our family team I think as well, is addiction and where that can, in very stressful situations, just exacerbate difficult situations. And we generally, if there is an addiction issue, we are made aware of it. I think we're fortunate in that clients and their other advisors are sensible enough to know that we need to know about it and that everyone's very discreet about it. But it can make those difficult situations that much harder. In your experience, do you think that there are ways in which we can help clients who do have those addiction issues effectively manage their legal decision-making a bit better?
I think it's a really fraught area, and I think this is something that any advisor, whether legal or not, can find it quite difficult to manage, because the capacity to give instructions with an addict can vary so rapidly within hours on a particular day, let alone from day to day. It's really important, therefore, that advisors who are dealing with clients with addiction problems, A, communicate with one another, because I think it's important that everyone understands what that particular client is going through in a particular phase, and it, as I've said, it can vary. But I also think it's a question of checking and double checking that you have properly understood what those instructions are. So you might get a phone call. I think we had a mutual client who would call and give us instructions on a Friday, which we both felt weren't necessarily what those instructions would be, having let the dust settle for a few days later. And so it's a question, I think, of calling back, just double checking, confirming and clarifying we think these are the instructions you've given us, can we just check documenting it and really giving the client another chance to review and double check themselves that is the decision that they would like to make, and doing it in a way that's discreet, there's no judgment involved. We're not saying that you definitely don't have capacity, we just want to check that this is really what you do want to do. And I think it's really important for that ongoing relationship, there's that element of no judgment, understanding. Absolutely. We're trying to make sure that this is the best possible outcome for you and your family, and that we have really understood what it is you're trying to do.
If it's the client you're thinking of, it was a very fraught situation with intergenerational relationships having completely broken down to the point where they were literally talking, a mother and daughter were talking through solicitors, and we felt that the mother who we acted for might have been under some sort of undue influence from somebody who's very close to the mother, and we were acting for her, and that really the temperature was being raised, as you say, sort of it build up in a crescendo towards the end of the week, and then actually by Monday, once everybody had a chance to think about it, it was much less acute.
And I think one of the issues that clients with addiction problems face is that they are very vulnerable to that undue influence. Mm. And again, we often see that in the litigation department, either in the context of will making or litigation as a whole, which is extremely fraught and stressful. And I think anyone who might have particular dependencies, and that's often going to be brought to the fore when you're under a lot of stress and potentially when family relationships are breaking down as well. I think anyone involved in litigation is going to be under that bit more pressure than perhaps they are able to cope with. And I think even the most robust of individuals can struggle with the stresses and strains of litigation, but particularly those with an alcohol or drug dependency or propensity for addiction issues, I think it can really bring those issues to the fore in a way perhaps they weren't necessarily themselves prepared for, and which we weren't necessarily aware of as being a potential issue at the outset.
I think that's right, and often we see people who are also quite peripheral to what we're doing actually having a much bigger impact on the planning that the family might be doing or the contentious situation they're trying to sort out. Actually, there's someone in the ear constantly, maybe once a week, just undermining, and often it's someone who's enabling the addiction as well, which is even more difficult to manage because we're often at two or three people's removed from that. We're just the lawyers, but you kind of know there's this influence there, and it can be very frustrating, I think, for those around the addicted individual to really try and sort of wean them off that sort of thinking. And it might be someone who's a really good friend of theirs, so it's really hard. Because if someone's supporting an individual who is perceived to be in a lot of trouble, and there's a really good friend who goes to see them every week, and that person is just dropping the odd acid drop into the conversation, which is really not helping in the bigger picture, but actually they're going to see them once a week, how you manage that. And I think that's a much more human problem than anything to do with the legal advice we're giving, but we do see it quite frequently, I think, people being undermined.
You see it a lot, and I think that area of influence or undue influence is a really interesting area legally, but sadly that's something that we see a lot when you're dealing with vulnerable individuals, and that whole sphere of influence is quite a difficult one. And often when we come to contentious wills, often it will have been the good, benign friend, potentially, who was perceived at the time as being helpful, but actually there might have been a dramatic change in someone's will, and trying to unpick and work out exactly what level of influence that person exerted over the individual in question can be very difficult.
Well, often they're entirely private situations, so it's impossible to work that out. And one of the things we find, I think, when there has been a mental health issue or diagnosis or ongoing illness, is that ultimately when there is a dispute, you need to work very hard towards actually just making things right. And it's not about necessarily winning and losing. And I think that that becomes even more acute where there's a mental health issue, in that you just want to have some sort of resolution. And it's not just a financial resolution, it's how you do it is important as well. And having been involved in some sort of contentious cases myself, obviously we all cross over, I know that the consensual, sensible, calm approach, often people come out of it and they feel quite refreshed by the fact they've been able to resolve matters relatively amicably.
So often when we're dealing with families and family disputes, we will be suggesting that the family contemplate mediation or dispute resolution at a really early stage in the proceedings and well before the family gets anywhere near the court door. Because once that happens, the temperature is raised dramatically. Any weaknesses or insecurities within the family are going to be exacerbated, and I think it's not in anyone's interest for that to happen unless it's the absolute last resort. So more often than not, these cases will mediate or settle amicably at a relatively early phase.
Well, thank you, Charlotte, for coming and talking to me today about a topic we talk about all the time, and I hope that people listening to this podcast will get a sense of how important we feel mental health issues are, both as individuals and lawyers at Farrers, and we have a whole team around us who feel similarly and give advice to people in difficult times, I suppose. It's been great talking to you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day, and I will bid our listeners farewell.
Thank you.